Hey, have you ever used Cheapo Air?
For years, and I really like it. With Cheapo Air, you can book online, use their app, or even over the phone. They've got great prices on over 500 airlines and millions of accommodations. They're my go-to for travel planning. And if you join their Club Miles program, you can earn points to save on the cost of your travel. Book on the app, and you get double points.
Sounds like it's time I tried Cheapo Air.
Call Cheapo Air at 855-247-3279 or visit cheapoair.com/podcast.
Welcome to Screen Talk, IndieWire's weekly podcast. I'm Eric Cohn, Deputy Editor and Chief Critic, joined as always by Ann Thompson, our Editor at Large. And we've got a lot of stuff to discuss today because even as we had this sense after TIFF that we kind of knew what the fall was like, new updates keep coming. We now have both opening and closing night film at AFI Fest, so you've got a chance out there on the West Coast to see two more fall season movies. Although, do you think that either of the opening night film or the closing night film on the basis of Sex and Mary Queen of Scots are really going to shake up the conversation? What's the expectation over there?
Well, we haven't seen them, so I'm not going to judge them in advance. What I hear through the grapevine is that there may be some good performances coming out of them, and certainly you're looking at a kind of, you know, royal squabbling match there between cousins, you know, royal cousins, Elizabeth and Mary Queen of Scots. So you've got Saoirse Ronan and Margot Robbie in costume in a period drama. I mean, I think The Favourite is the one that we can all assume is going to be the higher end version of that kind of movie. But that doesn't mean Saoirse Ronan, who's really an Oscar perennial, and Margot Robbie, who got nominated. They both got nominated last year for I, Tonya and Lady Bird. They're not to be underestimated, so we shall see. Basically, those films weren't ready to be in the fall lineup, and I think Focus made a very calculated decision that AFI Fest, which is in November, which is in LA, which is right in the center of all the awards action, was a good. It's always been a launching pad for movies like American Sniper and others, which brings up Clint Eastwood finally jumping in with the mule, as we I'd heard he was trying to finish in time.
We've seen Eastwood do this before, just squeeze into, I mean, American
Sniper. Million Dollar Baby is the classic, and it went on to win Best Picture. It really, Best Actress for Hilary Swank.
It'll be the second Clint Eastwood movie of the year after the more interesting than most people gave it credit for, 1517 to Paris. I assume this one is probably, at least the studio must have confidence that it's going to play a little bit better than that film did, which was basically ignored and maligned by most critics. In this particular case, you have Bradley Cooper already in the conversation with Star is Born. So I guess it'll be kind of interesting to see, you know, if this movie does insert itself into the conversation, it can only help amplify Bradley Cooper's profile in the weeks ahead.
Well, I'm sure Bradley's rooting for Clint on some level, but it does pit the two best actors against each other. Bradley, of course, in A Star is Born, which I went to see it a second time at the premiere here in LA. Just curious to see how it played here. And it had played so well in Toronto. And it was down at the Shrine, which is the setting for one of the big Lady Gaga songs in the movie, the final one. And I learned all sorts of things about the movie. You work the room, you learn, you know, it's been edited a lot, it's been tested a lot, but it certainly plays. And I have to assume that my gut response is that it will be an enormous hit.
Did you watch the movie again when you were?
Yes, yeah.
So what's it like the second time around?
Because that's a good question.
The first time, I felt like so much about this movie had been telegraphed to me by the time I sat down for it. And it didn't surprise
me. Because of its trailer. It was one of the best trailers I've ever seen.
Depends on what you're going for. I mean, to me, I was like, I kind of get what this movie's about. And it didn't surprise me, except that I did think that Lady Gaga is more exceptional than I was prepared for. I really feel like she defines the movie. The movie I thought was okay. It didn't wow me. But again, it's not my kind of movie.
We've had this conversation before. Yeah. You're not a big one for mainstream studio romances, which is what this is. And it's a musical, and it's a live musical. I have a great deal of respect for what Bradley Cooper did, and I recognize also that the screenplay was very good. It's a very good screenplay.
It's a very tight screenplay.
The dialogue is very good. It's very real. It's very, and what he's done with the acting, there's a scene in the opening hour during the whole falling in love part of the movie, which is really good. The whole thing at the beginning, the first hour is pretty damn good. And there's a parking lot scene where she starts to sing and he's fixing her hand. And it's just one of the most, it's a long, quiet, deliberate, very well directed scene and well acted scene. And then there's another, the singing is all great. I agree with you that Lady Gaga is owning this, but she's better in the first half than in the second. And Bradley has to play this character that's been played so many times before. And the relationship between him and his brother, played by the great, great Elliot, the white-haired Sam Elliot with the gravelly voice, and Bradley Cooper's basically leaning into that gravelly voice and imitating him, and their brothers, and there's a relationship there. He's going to get nominated also, Sam Elliot, finally, after all.
Well, I think he's good in the movie, and I understand the appreciation for him. He's not in, I think this narrative...
No. It's very short. You're right. That's why I checked it out the second time. And there's this one moment, for those of you who have not seen it, it doesn't mean anything to you, but there's this one moment where it's very quick, where he turns around in a car with some emotion. And I said, that's it. He's going to get nominated. You know, sometimes this happens. Like in Roma, there's one scene in Roma that's devastatingly emotional. I won't say which one. And at the end of it, I went, she's going to get nominated. I mean,
there's a lot.
That eye blink moment where you realize that there's an elevated moment that has to be recognized.
I will say though, there is a part of there's an aspect of the way A Star Is Born is being anticipated that I wonder if it will be in its favor or work against it and possibly even relegate it to a punchline this season, because that in part from that's in the trailer that's so widely cited. Where Cooper sort of out of the window is like, hey, I just wanted to get another look at you, has become this, you know, internet meme that is being kind of joked about by people who haven't even seen it. And that is, I think, sort of like the optics of that are weird, right? Because part of what this movie is about, even though this guy is deeply flawed, is
indeed,
is this a guy propping up this woman and to some degree kind of fetishizing her as, and then later seeing her as his savior from all the bad things going on in his life. And I don't know if that is a satisfying story for us to be celebrating.
I understand what you're saying. And I think they all recognize that the optics of someone with a serious drug and drinking addiction, you have to be careful. I think they were very careful about it. I actually think that the what it's really about, besides the fact that they fall in love with each other, but part of why they fall in love with each other is they recognize each other's talent. And it's about expressing yourself. And he helps to free her up from her shyness and her lack of confidence to express herself fully, and she goes along with it and allows him to do that. And I was very touched by their relationship. I believed it. And there's something about this movie and all the different movies like it and related to it that resonates still to this day. And I think it will play. I think it will play very well. Whether it's a Best Picture winner,
different question.
It's a whole other question.
Well, I mean, it's just there's so many different kinds of movies in the conversation this year. This certainly does seem like the most commercial one we've encountered so far.
Well, Black Panther.
I mean, but Black Panther is an anomaly in the sense we've never seen a superhero movie at the center of this conversation. So if Black Panther is a major best picture front runner as opposed to Star is Born, I think that would in some ways be more radical. Star is Born.
Well, I'm going to argue that there will be, you know, there could be several relatively mainstream studio movies in the race this year. We shall see. I mean, I am fascinated by Clint. The other person he could go up against, he's playing, he's an octogenarian, and he's playing an octogenarian, and he's going up against another octogenarian who says this will be his last acting role, which Clint is saying about The Mule, which is Robert Redford in The Old Man and the Gun, which is opening this week, David Lowery's movie. And yeah. I am a little concerned, even with Fox Searchlight behind it, that this very quiet, understated, charming, delightful movie has the big guns going that will keep it in the race for a right. long time.
Well, it's Fox Searchlight is very canny about how it campaigns for certain movies, and it's got some really good movies already that
including The Favorite.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, this one is maybe not one that it's going to go all in for, but the other challenge is, and I recall this from All Is Lost, is Redford is not the most aggressive.
He doesn't campaigning for himself. He's making appearances. He went to Telluride. He went to Toronto. He's making appearances, but he's not. He hates campaigning. So you're right. He won't.
No one's
going to go all in.
And Eastwood.
He likes to campaign to a degree.
It's like all about, you know, ego and kind of embracing the stardom that Redford kind of just coasts on. So, I mean, that is kind of fascinating, though, to think about those two guys competing after all these decades. It's certainly quite a contrast to some of the weirder, edgier possibilities that are in contention this year. So if indeed The Mule ends up being a part of the conversation in that.
Suppose it's so good. I mean, I haven't seen it, obviously. I have no idea. But so if it were really good, you could end up with Bradley Cooper and Clint Eastwood in Best Director, which is very odd to have two actor directors in there. And Joel Edgerton has a movie which won't end up there, but he would like it to, Boy Erased.
Yeah, I mean, this is also a very weird year anyway, because we have, I mean, this was something we were going to talk about in the context of New York Film Festival, which we'll get to in a bit, but you also have Roma and Cold War, both of which are gunning for foreign language, but could also potentially be in the Best Picture category. So in terms of what a traditional Oscar season looks like, it certainly seems like there's more porousness to the categories.
Well, I mean, on the one hand, we have these big studio movies that could be in the race, nice, big budget, healthy mainstream studio movies. And on the other, John Bailey, the Academy President's worst nightmare as they head into the, you know, Oscar show that they were proposing a best popular film category for, you know, and they've invited all these people from all over the world and younger people and more diverse Academy members. Well, the upside of that is that you could have Cold War, black and white, Polish foreign language entry starring unknown Joanna Kulig, who's amazing, and I hope she breaks out.
Yeah, she's awesome.
She's beautiful. And then you have the Roma, which plays for, I mean, it actually came in third ahead of A Star Is Born in Toronto. However, that voting was going online and it doesn't feel the same as it did before. But at any rate, Roma played well. And it does play well, and it's very emotional, and it's black and white, and it's Spanish language from Mexico. So you could have that in multiple categories as well.
Yeah, no, it'll be fascinating to see how that all shakes down, because the weeks ahead, there's going to be more opportunities for these movies to kind of get to audiences, and we'll just see more and more amplification of their campaigns. Right now, it's been more disparate, but it's just going to get more and more dense. And this extends also to the documentary side of things, which is more fascinating in the way that it unfolds, because it starts so much earlier in the year when you're exposed to these movies. But, you know, most of the movies we're talking about in the other categories, a lot of them come late to the party, more like in the fall season. We just got this Doc NYC shortlist. So this is sort of Tom Powers' survey of sorts of the documentaries that he thinks are in the conversation.
Yeah. So basically he's the chief documentary programmer at TIFF. So he has a say there. And then he's also the chief programmer, artistic director at DAC NYC. And then he's the one who solely creates, he has people programming with him. Then he curates this list of 15 movies that are designed by him to reflect on some level what, now there are a lot, there's the IDA and there's other groups that are voting, including mine at the Broadcast Film Critics Association. We're already voting. This is how early it is. We're working on our votes right now, and I've been in sort of intense screening mode trying to catch up because the list is very, very long. And I know a lot of Academy members are getting stacks and stacks of doc screeners. It's impossible for them to see them all. Yeah. So this is a very helpful curated list. And I think very reflective of what the final, it always overlaps to a
it's
degree.
It's been an interesting project because I know over the years people have said, well, maybe they need a committee or something because it's like one person making these calls.
He does very well. Well, I mean, how much is he dictating what will be and how much is he reflecting the quality of the films?
You know, people who feel threatened by it might say that, you know, either
it way. Be by one man.
Yeah. But I do think, I mean, I'm an individual, you're an individual, a lot of us have our outlets where we, you know, look at the field through whatever limitations we have and we come up with our own determinations about what's worth seeing and talking about. So on some level, this is a variation of that. And I talked to him about this. My sense is that this selection for this section is tweaked after Toronto. So it's not like it's just seeing the movies and making a decision. It's seeing.
No, there's three. There's three of them in there from Toronto, which is Netflix. You have to take all sorts of things into account. He has sponsors. He has distributors who supply him with films. He has people to keep happy. For example, if he's giving Wim Wenders a big award, then he sort of makes sponsor-focused features happy by putting Pope Francis in, which isn't really going to be, I think, an Oscar contender for all sorts of reasons. And then you have, you know, Quincy from, you know, Netflix has like three of them, and there's two from HBO. But this year he did lean in more than he has in the past to women filmmakers and first-time filmmakers and filmmakers of diversity. So it is a very diverse list, and I was happy, very happy that he included one of my favorites of the year, Crime and Punishment from Stephen Meng, which is very good.
I'm going to catch up with that one. I'm also a Broadcast Critics voter, so I need to have a few gaps I need to fill in. I haven't seen Jane Fonda, Life in Five Acts.
I haven't seen that yet either, and he was raving about that.
Some of the stuff on here is so far removed from traditional award season.
You mean like Shirkers?
Shirkers, I would love to see. I mean, if that movie really got a lot of love from the Academy, which is not unthinkable, that could happen. I was thinking more about something like Hale County This Morning, This Evening, which is totally experimental. A photographer's sort of document of this Southern community over the course of several years. But it's nice.
No, the more likely contenders, and I have to catch up with Hale County myself. It's on my definitely on my must-see list. The more likely contenders, of course, are the three big hits from the summer, Three Identical Strangers, RBG, and Won't You Be My Neighbor. And I think Free Solo, yeah.
Free Solo, to me, I mean, we talked about this last week. Free Solo,
it could take over, yeah.
Well, I mean, we'll see how it performs because it's just opening this weekend. It just seems like a movie that there will be a bigger conversation about the filmmaking here than there is in some of these other cases where it's more about the subject matter and how well treated that subject matter is. Minding the Gap is another one that I think could have be a conversation starter of sorts. Because
I was happy to see that in there, and people should totally see it. And that guy will win a lot of first-time filmmaking
awards. Yeah, Bing Lu is like 24, 25, I don't know.
And it's a very personal story, much like the other movie I was glad to see on there. I saw at Sundance called The Sentence, which is HBO.
That's a series.
It's picked up by them, and it's totally emotional, incredible story about a woman who's put in prison and the impact it has on her family, made by her brother, who's a really good filmmaker.
And of course, there's the Michael Moore
Rudy
movie,
Valdez,
which I feel like if he If that wasn't on there, you'd have a problem with Michael Moore. But that movie flopped pretty hard, and not everybody's over the moon about it.
It's interesting. Everybody, Michael Moore is on Twitter, and Tom Moore and Tom Powers even said to me, "Well, it's the biggest opening a documentary's ever had. You know, over $3 million." And it was like, yeah, it was in 1,700 screens, and it had a very poor per screen average. Remember what these things mean. So it really isn't going to make a lot of money now.
I mean, it should not be a surprise to anyone. There's nothing shocking, or there are no huge revelations in this movie. I did not. We watched it together. I think both of us we got stuff out of watching it.
I enjoyed it. It was entertaining, and the strong stuff was the Flint, Michigan, and the Parkland kids, and he went into he leaned into what he knew might sustain over time. This is the problem. He's competing with real. When have we ever encountered a fast moving news cycle? Speaking of which, we're recording during the Kavanaugh hearings.
Yeah, I got it muted in the background.
Crazy, crazy stuff going on in our lives.
And but that's a movie itself.
Important stuff, and he couldn't do it. He can't. It's a different time. People are asking. Tom Brueggemann, our box office guy, wrote a story explaining why. You know, Michael Moore exists in a different universe than he did when Fahrenheit 9/11 did so well.
But the miscalculation as well that hasn't really been acknowledged is that, yes, making something that is out of the news cycle is a mistake, obviously, because people need things that are timely. But if you don't want to try to make something that latches on to what the conversations that are people are having, you need to start those conversations yourself. So in other words, if you're not reacting to the news, you need to create news. And there's nothing new that comes out of this thing. So for example, Citizen Four.
I don't agree with that. I think there's stuff in there about Flint, Michigan that is way, way more in depth than anything that's been reported.
That's not particular. That's not national.
You should have done that story, and you would have been better off.
It's a little.
It is national. It's huge. Water's going to be an issue years.
I'm not downgrading
what the government did to them. Unconscionable.
What the governor did there, and Moore's gag there about putting him under citizen arrest is well founded. And Obama's response is obviously upsetting because he didn't take enough of a stand against what was going on there. But what I'm saying is that I don't feel like that itself is enough to drive the news. That most people are not going to go buy a movie ticket to see that.
All right, let's point out the obvious fact here, which is that the 2-hour movie that Michael Moore has lived and breathed for, and you know, for 30 years at this point, you know, since Roger and Me, that 2-hour movie in our fast moving, you were talking about social media amplifying what we're witnessing every day. It is in fact impossible to make that kind of movie now and have it be timely. I mean, what Laura Poitras did was break news, and how rare is that?
Yeah, I mean, but
she had an exclusive.
She was part of that news, of course, but also had this incredible access that was sort of built on the shoulders of the work that came before that.
That's true.
My question, I guess, about Moore is like, if he's going to make a movie as opposed to a series, and to his credit, he was making a series back in the 90s too.
And so he could go back to that format. Yeah, I mean, he's trying to figure out how to communicate with people now.
He is working on some kind of reboot for his show. But,
right.
But I think it's like, if you are going to do something in 2 hours, it needs to feel like it deserves that treatment. There are, if you look at some of the fall movies, like you look at Roma could not be a TV series. It is so specifically a movie.
Is Cold War.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And documentaries should be held to the same kind of scrutiny. Why is this particular amount of time in this format? You know, you look at Free Solo, that's a movie.
I'm not dumping on Michael Moore. I'm not dumping on this movie. I think it's perfectly fine. Is it going to make it into the top five of the best films of the year? No.
No, but I think it's not. What we're saying is also, it was just, it was, it was not necessarily the best application of his talent at this particular moment. I think that's
he's doing what he knows how to do. And I feel for him, actually. I think it's difficult to make those transitions.
I would like to see the Michael Moore brand continue to have some kind of resonance. And it's too bad that in this particular case, it hasn't seemed to do that. I know he's a little older now, but it seems like he's still a fighter. So the hope is that...
No, but I think he's outweighed his welcome in some... What's the word? Outlasted his welcome.
Well, the movie is kind of actually about that to some degree.
Well, he's trying to pass the torch to a younger generation. He was smart enough to acknowledge that.
Yeah, exactly. So the other festival update is that New York Film Festival is happening. I'll be there with our New York folks, and I'll be there in a couple of weeks for the closing night weekend. I have to tell you, it's really nice to see such a tightly curated festival where most of the quality has already been endorsed by its premieres elsewhere. The decision to focus on world premieres seems to have been very smart strategically, not just from a curatorial perspective, because from what I've heard, they're selling out. Nobody's complaining because they don't need a movie like, say, The Walk that premiered there a few years ago as opening night film that maybe some people like, some people don't like, just because it's a world premiere. You don't need that in a festival where there's like, you know, something like 30 films in the main slate. I've seen most of them, and they're good movies.
They made the decision to take these movies that were going to be in festivals and make them play for the local audience, and their ticket sales have gone up as a result, and I think they made the right call.
So I'm really looking forward to watching The Favorite again with a bunch of cynical New Yorkers, because I know they're going to have a blast with this.
I envy you that experience.
It's going to be a lot of fun, and then see what else is kind of playing around. I mean, there's stuff that will resurface that has already had an interesting life on the circuit, like, say, Errol Morris's documentary about Steve Bannon, American Dharma, which still hasn't sold, I think.
Because nobody wants to get close to it.
But I think New York lefties, you know, they'll play maybe well for that audience, I would hope. I think it's a movie that does deserve an audience and should be talked about, and talk about a movie that is in the news cycle. So that'll be an interesting one to see, you know, how it plays. And then you have other things that we've kind of come back to over the course of the last few weeks and months, like Border's going to be there and stuff like that. The Claire Denis film, High Life, which I thought was terrific out of Toronto and got acquired by A24. That's opening next year, but I think New Yorkers are going to flip for it. I saw this movie kind of late in the game, so I'm not, you know, relatively speaking, I'm not one of the first kind of, you know, big fanboys, as it were, but I really do think that this movie is going to be a cool one to kind of pick through. It feels like it's Claire Denis' style opening itself up to a broader crowd.
I'm glad that they're showing Private Life, Tamara Jenkins' movie.
I still need to see that one. I'm planning to see that one in a couple of
days. So good. And Catherine Hahn and Paul Giamatti are great. And it's a very New York movie. It's set in New York, about New Yorkers. And it's less... it's more of a marital drama and less of a comedy than you would expect with those very funny actors, but they're funny too.
And then I'm going to try to go check out If Beale Street Could Talk Again, which is going to have this, you know, kind of rock
the Apollo
style thing at the Apollo, which is that's a great idea.
I wish I could be there.
I mean, that was a movie that nobody really knew until the last minute how it was going to play, and it played well. And
it plays well. It played well in Toronto.
Yeah, yeah. In Toronto, the risk with a movie like that was that it is a very small, intimate piece of filmmaking, and you know, has to stand out. But I think the New York Harlem crowd's going to really go for it, and that's going to create some terrific word of mouth into release. So that's going to be another really fun one to talk about. And then you have other highlights from Cannes. You have things like Happy as Lazaro from Alice Rohrwacher, which is actually a really fascinating kind of magical realism fable-like thing that I can't wait to return to, because it's going to Netflix, and I think it's a 35mm kind of a big screen movie that I'm looking forward to revisiting. I was pretty sleepy when I saw it at Cannes, to be totally
honest. I was too, for various reasons. That's a movie that I liked very much until it really went a little bit off the deep end.
You know, I
in
love
the last half.
I mean, I'm all about a great you know, kind of swing into some kind of really bizarre.
Well, there were some cliched elements of that, which we won't get into.
So we can argue about that later on. And you got Burning, which Lee Chang,
which I highly endorse,
brought to Canon. That's
the Korean entry.
Yeah, and I think well deserved. And Lee Chang Dong has never been appreciated enough in North America, so that's going to be a really cool one to check out. I'm currently making my way through the 14-hour Argentine film La Flor, which I'm not exactly sure yet why it's a 14-hour movie, but I am intrigued by it, and the fact that it's in the main slate of the New York Film Festival gives you a sense of the kind of specificity through which this festival is programmed. I mean, it's programmed for New York cinephiles and people who want to see a range of quality cinema. And what it's doing on some level is it's elevating movies like that alongside Roma or The Favorite for a little window of time when you can actually provide this sort of snapshot that would otherwise not be viable. So I really think it's cool to see the way this program has sort of settled. And I don't know, we'll see how things play in the weeks ahead, but I'm looking forward to having you come out here. Next week, I guess we'll have a chance to kind of take a look at how The Favorite actually played on opening night, but I'm sure there will be other updates as award season continues to gain momentum. I'm not going to hope that you're resting up well this time, because I know that the busyness has already started.
I'm on it, believe me, it's crazy.
Stay with it. It's we're fighting for a good cause. So.
Okay. Talk to you later, Eric.
Bye.
Hey, have you ever used Cheapo Air?
For years, and I really like it. With Cheapo Air, you can book online, use their app, or even over the phone. They've got great prices on over 500 airlines and millions of accommodations. They're my go-to for travel planning. And if you join their Club Miles program, you can earn points to save on the cost of your travel. Book on the app and you get double points.
Sounds like it's time I tried Cheapo Air.
Call Cheapo Air at 855-247-3279 or visit cheapoair.com/podcast.